The separation of Abram and Lot is recorded in Genesis 13. So they left Egypt and traveled north into the Negev, Abram with his wife and Lot and all that they owned. For Abram was very rich in livestock, silver, and gold. Then they continued traveling by stages towards Bethel, to the place between Bethel and Ai where they had camped before. This was the place where Abram had built the altar, and there again worshipped the Lord. Now Lot, who was traveling with Abram, who was also very wealthy with sheep, cattle, and many tents. But the land could not support both Abram and Lot with all their flocks and herds living so close together. There were too many animals for the available pasture land. So an argument broke out between the herdsmen of Abram and the herdsmen of Lot. At that time, Canaanites and Perizzites were also living in the land. Then Abram talked it over with Lot. "This arguing between our herdsmen has got to stop," he said. "After all, we are close relatives. I tell you what we'll do. Take your choice of any section of land you want, and we will separate. If you want that area over there, I will stay here. Or if you want this area here, I will go to another place." Lot took a long look at the fertile plains of the Jordan Valley in the direction of Zoar. The whole area was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord or the beautiful land of Egypt. This was before the Lord had destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Lot chose that land for himself, the Jordan Valley to the east of them. He went there with his flocks and servants and parted company with his uncle Abram. So while Abram stayed in the land of Canaan, Lot moved his tents to a place near Sodom among the cities of the plain. The people of this area were unusually wicked and sinned greatly against the Lord. After Lot was gone, the Lord said to Abram, "Look as far as you can see in every direction. I am going to give all this land to you and your offspring as a permanent possession. And I am going to give you so many descendants that, like dust, they cannot be counted. Take a walk in every direction and explore the new possessions I am giving you." Then Abram moved his camp to the oak grove owned by Mamre, which is at Hebron. There he built an altar to the Lord.
Amen. One of the reasons I am so excited about studying the life of Abraham, is I desire to learn more of what it means to trust God. The Lord has continually shown me how much confidence I put in my own thinking and abilities, even if they're pitiful, and reasonings and desires. There are so many times where, even though I say I trust God, I have faith in Him, where I can feel myself trying to control a situation or come around and find my own solution. And the life of Abraham is an example of a life of radical faith. And that's the journey that I hope we can experience together and see what it means to really, really trust God. The interesting thing is, as we will see through the life of Abraham, the journey of faith is not like a gondola ride from the bottom of the mountain to the top. If you've ever been in a gondola, you know you get in on the bottom, and it's a straight, fast shot to the top of the mountain. You hop out of the gondola, and you have a beautiful view, and that was a nice trip. The journey of faith is much more like climbing out of a deep canyon, up those trails that zigzag back and forth on mule or by foot, and sometimes you actually have to go down in order to go up. Sometimes you don't think you're making any progress, but slowly you're gaining elevation. And you come over a ridge and you suddenly have a view that you never realized was there. That's what we'll see in the life of Abraham. I mean, one chapter, it seems like he is just a rock-solid man of faith, and then the very next chapter, he does something really foolish that reveals his confidence is back in himself. And I see myself in Abraham. And we learn a lot about radical faith. We've already learned a few things. Let's review. Chapter 12, verses 1 through 9, we learned that radical faith walks away from security. Radical faith walks away from security. God said, "Leave your country, leave your relatives, leave your father's house, and go to a land that I will show you. Now, I don't think most of us have any idea of the drastic step that was for Abram. Because for us, you know, hey, when you get to college, it's time to leave your family, leave your father's house. I mean, that's just a normal thing in our culture. In their culture, that was unheard of. Because your family, your extended family, the big family unit, was everything to you. I mean, that's where you learned your vocation. You didn't go off to college. That's where you learned your trade. That's where you earned your money. That was your military. I mean, your brothers and cousins were your army. That's where you found a wife. They all intermarried, you know, from the same family. I wanted to say it's a lot like Pickens, but I thought, better not go there. Sorry, I always pick on them. That was your retirement program. That was, I mean, they had no Social Security. So your kids, that's why they had lots of kids back then, your kids were your Social Security. They provided for you in your old age. So when God says, I want you to leave your father's house, leave your family, step out of everything that provides security for you, that was a huge step. That was radical faith, to believe the voice of God to that extent. But secondly, radical faith does not live in survival mode. We saw this last week. As soon as Abram stepped away from his father's house, famine set in. And it was very easy, as we are prone to do, you kick into survival mode. That is, you make good, rational, common sense decisions that may not be the will of God, but they make sense when you get in survival mode. I've got to do something. I've got to feed my family. I've got to protect. I've got to take care of. But there was no, in that context, there was no dependence on God. There was no seeking his face. There was no waiting on the Lord. And even though the text clearly said, does not say, as we saw last week, it doesn't say Abram sinned by going to Egypt. But all the indicators in that passage point to the fact that when Abram went his own way and that led to deceit and jeopardized his wife's safety and purity, you know, it was all downhill. And then when God rescued him in spite of Abram, which is just an amazing testimony to the loyalty of God, when he turned around and came back, the beginning of chapter 13, he built an altar and he called on the name of the Lord. You could see God's blessing on his hand. Get out of survival mode. Walk in dependence on God. So radical faith does not just merely live in survival mode. It doesn't just exist. It doesn't just do something. It's dependent on God. But thirdly, the passage we've come to today is chapter 13, 1 through 18. Radical faith is generous. That's a very simple way of putting the point of this passage out. It's secure enough to be generous. It puts others first. It lets go of its own rights. Now, this is not easy. Philip Yancey, in a book on money, expresses a struggle I think all of us can identify with. He writes, many Christians have one issue that haunts them and never falls silent. For some, it involves sexual identity. For others, a permanent battle against doubt. For me, the issue is money. It hangs over me, keeping me off balance, restless, uncomfortable, nervous. I feel pulled in opposite directions over the money issue. Sometimes I want to sell all that I own. You ever get that way? So sometimes I want to sell all that I own, join a Christian commune, and live out my days in intentional poverty. At other times, I want to rid myself of guilt and enjoy the fruits of our nation's prosperity. Mostly, I wish I did not have to think about money at all. But I must somehow come to terms with the Bible's very strong statements about money. I think Yancey articulates a common battle in our hearts. We fly from seeking poverty to prosperity. feeling we'd love to have one more thing to becoming just it all and wanting to throw it all away. We need God's perspective, because if we are merely listening to our culture's perspective, we are really confused. For example, a few years ago, PBS did a TV special they entitled Affluenza. Now, that's not about having a cold. That's the subtitled The Modern Day Plague of Materialism. So this is a secular perspective on Americans' materialism. And they included the following statistics. The average American shops 6 hours a week but spends only 40 minutes playing with their children. By the age of 20, the average TV viewer, this is average American, has seen 1 million commercials. Recently, more, this shocked me. Recently, more Americans declared bankruptcy than graduated from college. In 90% of the divorce cases, arguments about money played a prominent role. This plague so completely alters the way we make decisions and the way we relate to one another that it has visibly affected the birth rate in America. For example, as one businessman said, I love kids, but I don't want any. I'm too selfish to give what's necessary to raise them properly. Eventually, I'd resent their taking me away from my interests. So, very boldly saying what is obviously taken over in our country. So how do we come to a man who lived about 4,000 years ago in the book of Genesis and actually learn something from him about possessions? Well, in Genesis 13, we see a big conflict going on. It's like the Hatfields and the McCoys at the waterhole. The herdsmen were no longer merely protecting their flocks. They were attacking one another. They were marking off turf, trying to get a spot at the waterhole. And this ultimately resulted in a separation of Abram and Lot. There are three reasons the text describes as causing this separation. Number one, the land could not support them. The land could not support them. You see that in verse 6. Now the land was not able to support them that they might dwell together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. When I was in Africa, it was fascinating to learn how when it rained, all the herds and the flocks were congregated together, you know, near the waterhole. And when it rained, they would be sent out. Now, these little boys, typically tiny little boys, would be in charge of whole flocks, and they would be sent out for days, weeks, months to go as far away as they could to find good grazing grass. And then as the land dried up, they would eat their way back towards the waterhole. So the drier it got, the more flocks and herds would start congregating around the source of water. And pretty soon it would become like L.A. at rush hour, you know, where you've got all these animals trying to vie for the same little spot, and you would have rising temperatures and hot tempers. And that's what happened with Lot and Abram's herdsmen. The words used in this passage are really interesting. You'll see in verse 2, Abram is described as very rich. You may want to underline that, because that word rich is literally the word heavy. It doesn't have to do with his size. It has to do with, as it goes on to describe, Abram was very heavy in livestock, in silver, and in gold. He was weighty. He was rich. He was wealthy. But back in chapter 12, verse 10, the same word is used when it says, now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to dwell there, for the famine was heavy, severe. So the famine was heavy with heat and suffering, and when Abram came back, returning to calling out to the name of the Lord, he was heavy with flocks and herds and silver and gold. So you can see, in either case, whether we are weighted down with poverty, famine, or whether we are weighted down with prosperity, silver and gold and flocks and herds in that day, in either case, we are tempted to use the arm of flesh to resolve that difficulty. In chapter 12, the temptation was to find his own deceitful way of providing in the midst of poverty. And in chapter 13, the trial is one of relationships, which this seems to be much closer to America, doesn't it? Our trial is clearly, we are weighted down, and that heaviness of prosperity causes turmoil and conflict in relationships. Just look at the relationships in our country. So whether we're in poverty or whether we're in prosperity, we have a lot to learn from this man of faith. His men, as we see at the beginning of this chapter, did not respond well. The land could not support them, but secondly, there was strife between herdsmen. There was strife, like four kids arguing over the last cookie. These herdsmen had to divide the cookie in a way that was equal for all, and it wasn't going well. Their desire for food and water turned political, and the dividing lines fell between whether you're with Abraham's herdsmen or whether you're with Lot's herdsmen. The third reason for the separation is described as they were surrounded by enemies. You'll see that at the end of verse 7. They were surrounded by enemies. The Canaanites and the Perizzites then dwelt in the land. And this is pitiful, isn't it? When you realize, when petty squabbles become so insignificant and despicable, when you realize that we are fighting in enemy territory. The text points out there are Canaanites and Perizzites all around them, and they're arguing over the water hole. It's like the Democrats and the Republicans fighting about war in the midst when terrorism is intimidating the entire world. It's not the time to play politics. Well, fortunately, Abram steps in and takes the high road. He says in verse 8, Abram said to Lot, "Please, let there be no strife between you and me and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brethren. Is not the whole land before you? Please, separate from me. If you take the left, then I will go to the right. If you go to the right, then I will go to the left." What an amazing step of maturity and humility. Notice the manner of the separation. Abram was gracious. Two times he said, "Please." Now that doesn't probably strike us as significant unless we understand the order of authority in that day. Abram was the superior. All he had to do was snap his fingers and say, "Lot, you leave," and the problem's solved. And that would have been normal. That would have been accepted in that culture. Abram was the uncle. Lot was the nephew. Lot was the punk kid. "Get out of my area. Leave my herdsmen alone. Get away from my sheep and cattle. You go do your own thing. There's a nice desert pasture. Have fun." But here Abram, the superior, is saying, "Please." He's suggesting an alternative to the conflict with graciousness. Secondly, he was respectful. "For we are brethren." He was respectful. We are brothers. We are family. There's no reason for us to slaughter each other. He could have just said to Lot, "Listen, you punk kid, you should have stayed at home. Why'd you follow me? I hate it when my little brother follows me." I mean, Abram could have easily had that attitude. He was respectful. "No, we're brothers. There's no reason for us to be tearing each other apart." And then thirdly, he was selfless. Basically, he said to Lot, "Here's the cookie. You divide it. You take the bigger half. If you take this piece, I'll take the other piece." And again, when we read these stories, I don't think it hits us, because most of us are thinking, I don't care whether I have good land or bad land, or you know, whether my cattle are watered or not watered, because I don't have any cattle, I've never had any cattle, and I'm never going to have any cattle. No, but think of it this way. Let's say you have a real estate company. You have 100 properties. 50 of them are rented out, making money. They're in good shape. They're prosperous. 50 of them are in poor shape. They need renovation. They don't have renters. They're liabilities. They're not making money. You and your partner have trouble. So you go to him and you say, listen, we've got to part ways. This is too big, too much going on. Whatever the reason, it'd be better for both of us if we went opposite directions. I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll take the 50 losing properties that need renovation and renters and are making no money. You take the ones that are making money. You think that's crazy. That is economic suicide. That's what Abram did. Same scenario, different culture. You pick the good land, the land where your flocks and herds will flourish. I'll take the desert. I'll take the bad land. Wherever you want to go, you pick. I'll go the opposite way. What an act of humility, of deference, of generosity. From a financial perspective, he was setting himself up for destruction, to starve, and for his flocks and herds to die. But Abram was gracious and respectful and selfless. Lot, on the other hand, was probably the best word to describe Lot was simply unwise. Unwise. It's not that he did something sinful. It's not that it was wrong for him to choose first. And at this point in the story, it's not that he's done anything wicked. But notice the text points out in verse 10 that Lot lifted up his eyes. He lifted his eyes and he saw all the plain of Jordan. There's a spot there over the plain of Jordan that is about 4,000 feet high, and you can actually see the whole area. And in that day, before Sodom and Gomorrah was judged, it was like the Garden of Eden, or like the lush areas in the Nile that are overflowing with water. So it was like a paradise. And Lot, with his eyes, the text points out, looked, saw, and said, that's the best land. I want that. Now, again, was it wicked for him to do that? No, it was a good common sense decision, right? Who would do anything different? But it was so opposite of Abram's decision. It was based purely on the sensual. Not the sinfully sensual, but merely the senses. It was purely a business decision. I've got to feed my family. I've got to do what is right. I've got to take care of my responsibilities, so I will take that land. But there's something bigger going on here. Hello? I mean, life is bigger than the senses. Life is bigger than just the wallet and the payments. That's what we see perpetually through this text. Well, Lot lifted his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan, and that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go towards Zoar. And Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. But the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked and sinful against the Lord. Do you see how the author here does not come out and say that Lot at this point has made a wrong decision? It just drops hints. It's like when you're out playing in the afternoon and you've planned a picnic, and all of a sudden, off in the distance, you see dark, dark clouds. It's not raining yet, but that is ominous, foreboding. And those who have read through the story that know what happens to Lot's family get the eebie-jeebies at this point. And they say, Lot, no. The old King James, I think, says he pitched his tent towards Sodom. There's something eerie about that. Lot, I know it's not wrong, but what are you thinking? Don't move that way. You've got a wife and kids, and there's more to think about than just your wallet and your payments. But he moved that direction. There's something more than just looking at things from a human perspective. This past week, I was talking to a man who's just recently come to Christ in our church, and he was sharing with me, we weren't even talking about this passage, but he was saying, you know, before I was saved, and this isn't many months away, ago, he said, I just looked at everything that was immediate, visual, sensual, fun, satisfying, materialistic, that is what I wanted. And if it made me feel better, if it gave me immediate satisfaction, whatever it was, and he did it all, I would take it. All my decisions were based on that. He said, now that I'm a Christian, it's so weird because I look at everything from a totally different perspective. It's like there's a whole nother point of view brought in here, to where it's not just about the immediate and the satisfaction and what do I want right now. Something far bigger. And that's the contrast between Abram and Lot. It's not that Lot is going out, you know, doing wicked, wicked things at this point. It's the way he goes about his decisions. It's how he thinks. That's the problem. And trying to talk to somebody who thinks that way is like trying to talk to the wall, because they keep saying to you, what's wrong with what I do? Nothing wrong with that. You think it's so bad? I mean, show me in the Bible where that's wrong. But it's like, wait, 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 wait. Your whole point of view, your whole perspective, the way you make decisions, what you get up in the morning thinking about, what you go to bed at night thinking about, what you wake up in the middle of the night thinking about. Think about where you're coming from. Dads today especially need to take serious note of this, because it's a tremendous example of the difference of godly, wise, humble leadership and the guy with common sense. Common sense. The guy who just makes decent decisions. And the jobs we take and the movies we rent and the schools we pick and what we think about throughout the day will be reflective. As we lead our families, it will be reflective of what is really important and how we look at life. We'll look at the results of the separation in verses 14 through 18. You could summarize it this way: God blessed Abram. God blessed Abram. Sounds a little bit, you know, how do you put your fingers on that, around that? While Lot set himself up for destruction. And we're going to get a glimpse of that tonight in chapter 14, just a first step that Lot is taking to see the contrast. But let's read verses 14 through 18 and see the way God blessed Abram. And the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, lift your eyes now and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward, for all the land which you see I give to you and your descendants forever. And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if a man could number the dust of the earth, then your descendants also could be numbered. Arise, walk in the land through its length and width, for I give it to you. Then Abram moved his tent and went and dwelt in the terebinth trees of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and built an altar there to the Lord. You'll see in that chart in your notes, I'm not going to be able to go into the details of this, but just a fascinating similarity between what Abram offered Lot and what God offered Abram. And it's amazing, because it's as if this, follow me here. It's as if God said to Abram, because you've said no to the immediate satisfaction, the cravings that man would normally pursue, I want to give you everything you've said no to. Do you see that in that chart? First of all, Abram said to Lot, look, And Lot lifted his eyes and saw. So Lot is looking around saying, I want the best land here. It's not sinful. It's just purely him looking around the plains of Jordan for the best land. And look what God says to Abram. Same wording, almost exactly the same. Verse 14, lift your eyes now and look. Abram offered Lot, if you take the left, verse 9, then I'll go to the right. And look what God said to Abram, for all the land which you see, I give to you. So what Abram offered to Lot, God offered to Abram. Same thing is true. Lot claimed the land, verses 11 and 12. Lot chose for himself all the plain, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain. And in verses 17 and 18, God said to Abram, arise, walk in the land through its length and its width, for I give it to you. Isn't that amazing? What is he saying? This is just such a dominant theme throughout all of the Bible. If you seek to save your life, you what? You lose it. But if you will lose it for my sake, you're going to find it. Over and over again. Like we heard sung about today. Jesus let go of his name. I mean, he was ridiculed, he was misunderstood, he was misrepresented, he was reviled. And God gave him a name above every name. Abram said to Lot, listen, you take whatever. And God comes along and says, Abram, I want to give you whatever. Why do we cling? Why do we fight? Why do we crave? Why do we covet? Why do we grasp? Well, there's a fascinating parallel, and I'm going to share it with the shepherding group leaders, so maybe they could go through this if it's of interest with you, but we don't have time to do it this morning, but between Ephesians, the breakdown of Ephesians and actually the breakdown of this chapter is an amazing parallel. The promises that God gives us as believers, if we will let go of our lives, he will bless us beyond our imagination. He did the same thing with money with the Philippians. Remember that? He said thank you to the Philippians for them sharing in his struggle. And they shared to the point of loss. And that's when he gave that famous verse, but my God shall supply all of your need according to his riches in glory. But that's given in a context of people who had let go of their money. You let go of your money. You let go of your pursuits, your covetousness and your greediness, and let God come around the back door and meet your needs in ways you would never have imagined. That's what he's calling us to. It's not a life of clinging and grasping. You could summarize it this way, the big point. When we put our confidence in God, we will be generous. When we put our confidence in God, we will be generous. We will not worry about what people think of us. We're not going to worry about trying to keep up with everybody or impress anybody or what we think we need. We're not going to worry about what people think or what we think we need. Grasping, clinging. And so this life of radical faith pulls us out of the survival mode. And suddenly, folks, every decision becomes a Shekinah decision. You know, where the presence of God enters into every decision. It pulls us out of the survival mode where we're just saying, now, what would a good, rational American do in this case? And puts us in a place where we start seeing God at work. At work. Seeing God in our homes and in our decisions. Take this case with Abram. Abram and Lot had relational conflict. How was it solved? Well, this wasn't just a battle over the water hole, folks. Do you see, what Genesis 13 does is it puts this this relational conflict in the context of faith. This is a faith issue, not just a relational issue. It's not just about putting up with your selfish mate or changing an obstinate teenager or putting a coworker in their place. Faith asks this question, and this is, I believe, the best way to get right down to what he's talking about here. What is God doing here? What is God doing in my life in this relational conflict? Or what is God teaching me? Or what is God doing in this financial strain? Or what is God doing in this workplace? You start asking questions like that, not just how can I fix this or how can I meet this need or how can I get more money or how can I put this person in their place, but you start asking it from a perspective of radical faith, saying, God, I don't know what you're doing here, but I want to see you in this marriage, changing the way I relate to my wife or this nasty neighbor or whatever it is. Lord, show me. And it suddenly changes it all. Not always suddenly, but our perspective becomes totally different. That is why you have to admit that this conflict in Genesis 13 is not about just good relationships. It is about faith. As James 1 says, that these trials we go through is really testing our what? As we've talked about before, we say, she tries my patience, right? She's not trying your patience, she's trying your what? She's trying your faith. Your faith. Say, what does that have to do with it? She's just obnoxious. Doesn't have anything to do with faith. Yes, it has everything to do with faith. Do we believe God put him in your life? Do we believe God sovereignly said, hey, she needs to be in a relationship like this. She needs to be in a work environment like this. He needs to be in a marriage like this. This doesn't excuse sinful activity, but it suddenly turns this into an exciting adventure of faith. God, what did you want to do in my life so as to bring this about? I'm listening. Get out of the martyr complex. Quit whining. And jump on the journey of faith and say, God, you do something here, not just to fix them, but change me. That was Abram's posture. You want to go right? I'll go left. I'm listening to God. Look quickly, because in 1 Timothy, Paul applies this specifically to money. And helps us understand that the money thing is not, giving is not just about being unselfish, it is about being believing. It's about faith. Real quick, 1 Timothy 6, 17. Command, 1 Timothy 6, 17. Command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty. Don't be proud about your wealth. He's talking to every American here. Nor to trust in uncertain riches. You see, he makes it a faith issue. Don't put your confidence in riches because they're uncertain. It is a shaky footing. Don't trust in them. But in the living God, put your faith in him. What does he do? He gives us richly all things to enjoy. So it's not about whether you're rich or poor. It doesn't matter. Whether you have things or don't have things, that's not the key. It is about God. So how do I keep from trusting in uncertain riches? Verse 18, let them do good that they may be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share. What are they going to do if they do that? Verse 19, storing up for themselves a good foundation for the time to come that they may lay hold on eternal life. You see, it's not about today. It's not about grasping. It's not about clinging. It's not about fighting, having more, coveting. Jesus said the same thing in Matthew 6. Therefore, I say to you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food and body more than clothing? Seek first the kingdom of God. And then, like with Abraham, God will come around and just, he'll say, hey, what do you need? What do you need? Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about its own things. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. An old preacher put it this way: the less of our energies are consumed in asserting ourselves and scrambling for our rights and cutting in before other people so as to get the best places for ourselves, the more we shall have to spare for better things, and the more we live in the future and leave God to order our ways, the more shall our souls be wrapped in perfect peace. And that's what happened with Abram. Whereas he flopped in Egypt, he came out of Egypt, and it seemed like he learned his lesson. We're going to see later he's going to struggle with the same thing. But he responds to Abraham, to Lot, with great faith. And God just floods him with blessing. This is the way I would put it, if you want to write this at the bottom of your notes to go home and apply it. I would put it this way. God, as you speak to God about applying this passage, God is calling me to trust him in blank. Or with blank. And to blank. You know, God is calling me to trust him with, whether it's a relational conflict or a financial worry, to be able to say, God, I'm going to commit that to you, and I'm going to take a specific action. It says, and to, just like Abraham purposely set himself under Lot, I'm going to deliberately, and I don't know what that means for you. But as Americans who have been flooded with physical sensory blessings, we would do really well to say, God, please teach me like Abram, that if you bless me financially, I want it to be because you did it, not because I'm craving it. And if you do bless me that way, then I want to know, like 1 Timothy talks about, that you've done it for a reason so that I can look around and say, God, what can I invest in the kingdom? How can I invest in the kingdom? How can I put my resources that you've given me in a place where they will extend into eternal life? Because I don't want to be just caught up with looking at the now and accumulating and grasping. Lord, I pray that you would apply this truth to us. I pray that you would give us, as those who are fathers, wisdom in leading our families, that we would not be just good common sense leaders, but that we would be men of faith. I pray that you would give our mothers faith, confidence in you. Lord, I pray that our teens and our singles and our adults, Lord, that all of us, our children, would not put our confidence in the survival mode or the arm of flesh or the thing we that our culture views as wise, but that we would heed your word and follow your counsel and lock in on trusting you. Lord, I pray now as we close that your Spirit would take this message that could be applied in so many ways, and Lord, take by your Spirit, apply your word specifically to where we are and where you want us to be. And Lord, I thank you so much for the encouragement. There's such a relief. We can breathe out. We can truly enjoy life when we realize that you are the blesser. We are the blessee. We can rest in your promises. We don't have to worry. We don't have to grasp. We can let go of covetousness and greediness and strife. And we can walk in peace as you are the God of peace. We thank you in Jesus' name.